Welcome to the Mommy Beta Podcast. This is episode 85 of the show where we talk about what we've been blogging about and talking about on mommybeta.com. Today we're going to talk about raising boys, giving birth the way you want to give birth, and a few tips for cloth diapering. You have the Natalies today. I'm Natalie Morris. Natalie Gaffori is also on the show. Jennifer just gave birth to a beautiful baby boy. I'm going to not steal her thunder and let her tell you all about that later. And Alex is off today. How are you, other Natalie?
I'm doing good. I just, like I was saying before we jumped on, that I finally got the baby asleep. He has been giving me some fighting lately. I think part of it is that he's really found his voice, and he's starting to do the da, 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 and he just likes to hear himself talk. So we get a lot of da, 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 da in the middle of the night and while he's trying to go down for a nap, but he's asleep.
Yeah, you know, when they start to reach various levels of cognition, then they start to want to fight their sleep a little. So I feel like even if you have a really good sleep-trained baby, you have to keep going through these stages.
Yeah.
So I have that with Ava, too, because she's getting so active. But she's asleep, too, thank goodness.
Woohoo!
So this week, we want to, again, congratulate Jennifer on a successful VBAC. She's got an amazing story. I talked to her for about an hour last night, and I just was so inspired by it. But I don't want to tell too much of it, except to say that we kept texting each other, and the four of us were just so proud of her.
Amazingly proud.
So proud.
She's a warrior.
Yeah. I mean, she set her mind to that VBAC, and she shared on many times on the Mommy Beta podcast about how she was so nervous about choosing a VBAC or another C-section, and she went back and forth, and then she put her mind to it, and she accomplished it, and she had amazing support, and she did it. After, you know, long, long labor, she did it, and she's so happy. And we're so happy to have
him. Congratulations, Jennifer.
Yeah. So she had a boy. Alex is also having a boy. I have a boy. And you have two boys. So that's why I was particularly interested in reading this book called Raising Cain. And I wrote a podcast, I wrote a blog post, rather, about it last night. I'm about a halfway through. But I can't stop thinking about this book. Have you heard of this book before?
I hadn't, actually.
Okay. So a friend of mine told me about it, and she's having her second boy. And I thought, oh, this does sound like something that I would read. And the title of the book is called Raising Cain, Protecting the Emotional Life of Boys. And it was written by two school therapists who, after years of working in schools and working particularly with troubled boys, saw a pattern of how we really isolate children, particularly boys, in school, and don't teach them anything to do with emotional education. They talk about our culture and how we're sort of a culture of get over it, bootstraps, sports, bigger is better, feelings are for weaklings. And that really isolates boys. And they talk about how young boys particularly feel just as much emotion as girls. In fact, baby boys cry more than baby girls. They just feel more sensitive. Their brains fire, and they, you know, they're able to tell that they are more sensitive to things than baby girls. But that changes through the course of our lives, and we sort of think we should toughen up our boys for the real world. But what that actually does is make boys feel as if they can't trust their emotions, that they should shut down their emotions, and they get so confused and scared, and they go inside themselves, and this is really how we come up with problem children. And I thought this was such an interesting topic to discuss, especially because we're talking about school violence and bullying lately a lot. And why not think of the underlying cause of how we treat these boys and how we teach them about emotional education? What's your first reaction to this?
I think when you put in the little sentence that said, you know, doesn't this relate to school shootings, or can't we see how this is tied together? That kind of surprised me because I had never thought of it in that way. We always think of, at least I tend to think of, school violence as more of a mental illness issue. But maybe it's not. Maybe it is more about kind of the emotional capacity of these kids. And even on a, you know, much less grand scale, you know, we already see things like this in preschool, where we kind of expect the boys to be a little bit tougher, or maybe we're a little bit more sensitive with the girls than we are with the boys. And I think that really, it does say something about how these boys are kind of from the very beginning told to push down their feelings and what can happen.
Right. And Columbine was not, they were not mentally ill. Right. They were just marginalized, extremely marginalized boys mm-hmm. who were never allowed to feel what they felt, and they felt on the margins. And the authors point out that young girls are twice as likely to use words like love or sad or scared, whereas at the same time, boys are twice, sometimes between 6 and 8 times more likely to get punished or hit for the same crime as a little girl. So running, jumping, hitting, they'll hit boys. They won't hit girls. So what are we teaching them about, you know, whether or not they're a success or a failure? We teach them that, oh, I'm just a boy. This is my, you know, and a lot of times we blame it on testosterone, but the science points out that there's no difference in testosterone until age 10. So girls really? Have the same amount of testosterone as boys do, but boys are slower to learn and more mm-hmm. quick to advance physically. So when you get them in a classroom where you're supposed to learn and stay still, they have a bit more challenge at that. And because the girls are succeeding and they're not, then they start to label themselves as a slow learner. And there's this anecdote in the book where a guy is talking to a fellow therapist about writing up his notes. And he goes, you know, I don't know why I even bother, because it's all the same story when it comes to these problem teenagers is, you know, slow to learn to read, learn to hate himself, pissed off at the world, joined a gang, goes on drugs. Wow. And that was sort of like they're almost a joke that this is what happens. And so I'm not to the point where they give any prescriptions for how to raise a more sensitive boy. And of course, there are some who are going to say that we're sissying up our boys, and that's something that really will get raise the hair on my neck. But
right.
I think that there are some things that you can do to help your boy particularly acknowledge their feelings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we do a lot about how does that make you feel? And he's actually really started to verbalize things. Like if something happens and he gets upset, I say, you know, what's going on? Can you tell me how you feel? And he says, it makes me angry when you do that, or I feel upset, or I'm sad, or I'm scared. And sometimes I don't think he's using the right word for the emotion that he's feeling, but we're working on it, trying to identify what he's feeling and putting a word to it so he can express it. And I think it's good to just kind of get the gates of communication open and get them comfortable with talking about how they're feeling, whether they're feeling happy or whether they're feeling sad. Because in our culture, we express our positive emotions so much more than we do our negative emotions. And I feel like, at least at the beginning here, where he's just trying to figure out what his emotions are, that we need to talk about both. You know, I don't need him to be I'm not going to call him a Debbie Downer if he tells me he's sad. I want him to feel that, and I want him to know what to do with it, mm-hmm. to say, okay, I feel sad. How can I make myself feel better? Instead right. of just pushing down the fact that he feels sad.
And there's also research from another book I read called Raising an Emotionally Intelligent Child, that if they're able to realize that it's an emotion and it's temporary, they can work through it faster. Whereas mm-hmm. if they don't realize that emotions are just something that will come and overwhelm you, they'll feel like it's a temporary state and it will really overwhelm them. And the same way we can get overwhelmed by emotions. But if they realize, like, oh, this is a feeling, even if he is using the wrong word for it, he knows that it's an emotion and that he can take control of it rather than it taking control of him.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it makes me really sad to think of the way we would marginalize boys. And I think it surprises me because, you know, as a woman, a lot of times I feel like we live in a patriarchal society, yet, you know, there's so many ways that we can just be cruel to boys and set them up for failure. And they point out how a lot of times a child's education is solidified by grade 2. So if they feel like they're a failure by the second grade, it's almost impossible for them to turn it around and feel good about school.
Yeah, and we've talked about before that we've had some issues with Nick in school and in daycare as far as hitting other kids and that sort of thing. And I never want him to feel like he is the problem kid. I never want to give him that label or tell him that he's had problems, because I want it not to be a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Mm-hmm. And it would be.
Yeah.
It would be.
So I think I've expressed to everyone, you know, close to us, that we don't treat him like the problem kid. We treat him like a kid who's trying to figure out how to control his behavior. So I think that's very, very important.
Yeah, it is. And in fact, one of these therapists talked about a child that his parents had reached out for help. And he says, I usually try and talk to the teachers and the parents and the child as the last resort, because even going to the school psychologist could mm-hmm. frame them in their own head as like, oh, there's something wrong with me.
Mm-hmm.
So, and you know, they see it through to the end to children who are bullying and hurting other children. And I, you know, in other ways, they give some anecdotes of how young boys make each other fight and pee on each other's homework and all these things. Aww. That make me so sad, especially as a girl. I just kind of almost can't even finish reading it because it's so upsetting. But a friend of mine once told me this saying, and I can't stop thinking about it as I read it, that hurt people hurt people. Have you ever heard that?
Oh, no, I haven't.
But it makes a lot of sense in life, in all facets of life, but this mm-hmm. in particular, that, you know, these are young hurt boys with no outlet for figuring out how they feel, and they take it out on other people.
Oh, that's sad.
Yeah. So a good read. I really, really recommend it so far. And like I said, I'm only halfway through, so I'll share a little bit more. But speaking of fighting the good fight, there was an article that I found. This is not a brand new article, but it was in The Guardian about a month ago. And I think it was really, it's really worth talking about in the light of having a new baby Beta and Jennifer having a VBAC. It's called The Fighting Back Against Birth Intervention. And this may be more of a thing in the UK, but I think it's something here too. And it's an example of all of these women who are fighting back against what the doctors say about how they should give birth and choosing how they should give birth. And I found this really inspiring, especially because, like I said, Jennifer succeeded at her VBAC after putting her mind to it. Why do you think there's such a culture of pushing women to have babies in the way the medical community wants them to?
I think a lot of it has to do with money and insurance and how much it costs to be in a hospital and how valuable hospital space is. I mean, you know, I don't think most hospitals will allow you to be in labor for 2 days or more. Mm-hmm. And just because you're taking up space, other people need to get in there and have babies, which maybe we need to build bigger hospitals. I don't know what the answer to that is, but I think a lot of it has to do with that we're, you know, it's this is kind of at a premium in every sense of the word. You know, it's costing money, it's costing space, it's costing people's time. And, you know, we're kind of an instant gratification society. If it's not happening now, it's not good.
Right.
So I think that all of that kind of comes together. And then, of course, there's also the concern for the mother and the baby. And you know, sometimes protracted labors can lead to negative side effects. But so can C-sections. So.
Yeah.
Or other interventions.
So I guess there's a documentary that's out now called Freedom for Birth about women's rights to choose how their child is born. And I'm just so curious about how you can make decisions if it's not going the way you want it to. And one of the things that Jennifer told me over and over when I talked to her last night is she kept waiting for someone to say, you know what, we're just going to do a C-section. And no one ever said that to her. No, because they respected her wishes. And I think that's, you know, that's really what you need in order to succeed is you need support here. And in some cultures, they're just not getting it. So it looks like Natalie probably has to run after a baby. So we'll keep going. We also have a post on mommybeta.com about cloth diapers. And I'll post a link in the show notes to the fighting back and birth intervention. And we'd love to hear your stories as well, because I'm sure Jennifer's not the only one fighting this good fight. So, speaking of good fight, Natalie and I are both cloth diapers, and she wrote a recent post about cloth diaper hacks. Now, she's been at it for about 3 years, and I've been at it for, I guess, about 2.5 years now. My son is 2.5, and I started when he was 3 months. And she has some really great tips here for how to make cloth diapering less complicated. One of them, she talks about using pre-folds as inserts. And so she takes the insert of her pocket diaper and puts it inside of a pre-fold. That's a really clever way to do things. And then she talks about using bigger pre-folds to fit.
Actually, it's the other way around, Nat. I use the pocket diaper itself, but if I don't have enough inserts, because some of the pocket diapers only come with one insert, which just is not absorbent enough.
Right.
So I'll take one of my smaller pre-fold diapers, my newborn pre-fold, and I'll fold it into thirds, and I'll use it as an insert along with another insert inside the pocket diaper.
I didn't understand that. Oh, that is clever.
Yeah.
Because sometimes I use the insert from the pockets to at night inside the prefold.
I've actually just started doing that too.
Yeah.
I'm using some hemp inserts inside my my nighttime prefolds because they're just – he pees everywhere.
You got a super soaker. Yeah. You know, Ava wasn't a humongous super soaker, but she's starting to be. And I think because she's teething, she's nursing more. And so I've had to kind of double up. But for a while, I thought, oh, maybe it's just boys because Miles was a super soaker. And, you know, in all the videos, you see them sort of doing extra steps for boys in all the cloth diapering 101s.
Yeah. And I feel like most of what because I've done a fair amount of research on super absorbency solutions, and most of the moms who are talking about their kids being heavy wetters are mothers of boys, so maybe there is something to that. Yeah. Or maybe it's just the placement, that because it all comes out in the front, there's more issues. But yeah, I think the moral of the story here is that you can be confident in just mixing and matching and finding what works for you. You don't have to use the diapers exactly as prescribed or exactly as they have been designed. You can kind of figure out what's going to work for you and what's going to save you some money. I think one of the best things that I've done is I used these the Osso-Cosi Better Fit prefolds, which were awesome because you only have to kind of trifold them a little bit at the front instead of having to fold them over and then trifold them. So they're a little bit slimmer and it just kind of saves you a step. So those have been great. But when he outgrew those, I was thinking, okay, do I need to buy another set of pre-fold diapers? Or am I going to buy more pockets? I had some pockets from you, which was great, but I didn't have enough to go through the whole rotation. So I was lucky enough where I won this little contest and I got sent a kit of these real nappies, which are actually really great. I really, really like them. But they were a size bigger than what he was typically ready for. They were 4 6 months plus, and he was about 3 months. So I thought, well, I'm just going to try this and see if it works because they're pretty big pre-folds. So I just folded them a little bit extra, and he's been able to wear them since the time he was 3 months old. So it saved me probably, I don't know, $20 to $50 of having to buy that in-between size of folds.
Yeah, they're not cheap.
Mm-mm. And the pre-folds are definitely much less expensive than the pockets, but you know, it was nice to be able to skip that step and not have the waste of buying them and then, you know, wears them for 3 months and then what do I do with them? So this has been great. They were a little bit bulky at first, obviously, because there's just more fabric there, but it's not a big deal.
Yeah. And I do this using the pocket shells for covers as well. I've done that before. And especially we went through a time when my son Miles had to wear disposable diapers at nighttime only, because even though I was able to find him something that held the pee, the fact that the cloth inside was so soaked was giving him a little rash. So I had to do nighttime disposables, which bummed me out a little. But then I still needed something to go around the disposables because he was still even peeing past those nighttime disposables. Wow. So I would use the pre-fold covers around a disposable, and that's how he slept for a while. And then when I was out of those, I would just use the pocket as a shell almost.
Oh, that's a great idea.
Yeah, around a disposable. And even moms of disposable diapers, I always recommend that they get one of these pre-fold covers because, you know, those nighttime diapers are only going to go so far. So
right. Yeah, I think I remember even putting the hemp insert into nighttime diapers for Dominic for a little while when he went through his super heaviest wetting phase. We used the 12-hour nighttime disposable, and then put a hemp insert or two inside, and that did the trick.
Oh, I hadn't thought of that. That's a good idea. That's a good idea too. But now that he's, you know, he's potty trained for the most part, but he still sleeps in a diaper. Does Dominic?
Yes, he does. Yeah, I was going to talk to you about that. When do you think you're going to try to stop that?
Well, sometimes the diaper's dry in the morning, and sometimes it's almost always dry after nap time. But it's not – sometimes it's dry and sometimes it's not. And I figure I just wait until the diaper is dry. Because do I really need to disrupt his sleep by making him pee all over himself and teach him something in his sleep? I'm not sure I'm really ready for that.
It's just on his crib, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
So he can't even get out to go to the bathroom or wake me up.
Right. Yeah. I definitely didn't want to do it before we were out of the crib. But he's out of the crib now, but I don't want, he's good about staying in bed. So I don't want to teach him that he can get out to go to the bathroom.
Yeah. Cause then it becomes a ploy.
Right, exactly. And yeah. I don't want that. So he's actually calling me right now. He says, I want some Milky, Mommy. So I might have to take a quick break and jump off and get him some Milky.
All right. Well, we're about to wrap up anyhow. So go get the milk. And then I wanted to throw out one more question to our readers. If you are a cloth diaper mommy, I want to know what you do with your cloth diapers when you're done with them. Because I have a stash and some of them I've donated to friends. And then some of them, you know, I think maybe won't fit other friends' babies. So I'm looking for a site to donate used cloth diapers. And I know that there's a good resale market for them, but they've been through two babies, and I don't really want to make money on them. I want them to go to someone who really will use them. So if you have any suggestions on where to donate or otherwise give away used cloth diapers, please let me know. You can email us at mb@mommybeta.com or write it anywhere on the site. You can do that as well. We read your comments, or on Facebook. We are Mommy Beta on Facebook and Twitter as well. Thank you for joining us this week on the Mommy Beta podcast, and we'd love to hear what you have to say about taking control of your birth or raising boys or cloth diapering or any of that. Please do send us your feedback. We'd love to hear it. Thanks for listening, everybody. Have a great week.
Bye, everybody.